Whoa. The committee of the whole will come back to order. The next bill for consideration is Senate File 146. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 146, introduced by Senator Escobel, an act relating to children, modifying provisions relating to family reunification as specified, providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman of Committee Number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 146, engrossed, termination of parental rights, respectfully report same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Those who voted aye, Representatives Baker, Connolly, Gingery, Halverson, Croker, Crone, Miller, Walters, one no vote, Representative Watt, signed by Representative Crone, Vice Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Vice Chairman Crone?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File Number 146 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. And, Mr. Chairman, I would turn the explanation of the amendment and the bill over to my good colleague from the place where the university is.
Representative Connolly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, folks, I want to first talk about the Standing Committee Amendment. And so if you'll bear with me, because honestly this is an important but simple bill, but it looks a bit complicated. And so to understand the genesis of the Standing Committee Amendment, you need to understand the genesis of the white copy of the bill, the blue copy of the bill, and then the Standing Committee Amendment. So when the bill was originally drafted by the bringer of the bill on the other side, he had it mistakenly put in Section B of this statute. And so what the Senate did is just pick up the language that went into B and stuck it in C, which is where it belongs. However, it didn't track into C correctly, so LSO came up with a Standing Committee Amendment that tracks the language correctly into C. And so if you'll just believe me that this is now where this language belongs, then I can talk about the bill. And so if I could call for the question on the Standing Committee Amendment, then I can talk about the bill and what this language actually does.
Did you move the
Standing Committee Amendment has been moved, and so I'd like to call for the question on the Standing Committee Amendment.
Question being called. All those in favor of the Standing Committee Amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment has passed. We're back on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. 142309 is our statute that establishes grounds for termination of parental rights when a child is in state custody. It's a process that involves both the courts and the Department of Family Services. Admittedly, it is an onerous process, and it should be, because parenting is a fundamental right. However, we have an obligation as a state to step in and care for kids who are being abused and neglected by their parents. And in the most severe of those cases, the kids end up in foster care. And in the most severe of those cases, those children become available for adoption. So that being said, 14309 has three parts to it. Part A, which this bill doesn't address, but this bill addresses a portion of Part A. Part A of 14309 establishes when the parent-child relationship can be terminated, and it includes in it Romanet 3. Romanet 3 has three elements to it. When a child has been abused and neglected, second, when reasonable efforts by DFS have been unsuccessful in rehabilitating that family. And three, when it's been shown that the health of the child would be seriously jeopardized by staying with the family. Okay? So again, there are three elements in Part A. One of those elements requires that the Department of Family Services attempt to reunify that family. Okay. We can skip Part B. All right, because Part B has nothing to do with this bill except for that was where it was mistakenly put to start with, which allowed for the termination of parental rights when, for example, a parent had murdered a child in the family or something along those lines. Part C goes to when the Department of Family Services may not be obligated by a judge to attempt to reunify the family. And again, there are very narrow circumstances that get back to Part A, Romanet 3, in terms of the state's obligation to at least look into reunification. And what this bill does is simply add several elements to when a court may not require the DFS to attempt reunification. And those are in the circumstances that are listed there. When a parent has been convicted of a sexual crime against a child in that family or another child in that family, or is on the sexual offender registry because of a crime perpetrated against a child in that family. And with that explanation, I would ask for your favorable consideration.
Is there discussion? Mm-hmm. Representative Davidson. Chairman Davidson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just remind the body, this, I think this is a good bill, and I would just remind it, this bill gives the DFS an option for juvenile court to order relief, and it also makes us come in compliance with the CAPTA, which is the Wyoming Complaint with the Child Abuse Treatment Act. So I hope you'll consider and vote aye on this bill.
If the question being called, all those in favor of Vice Chairman Crone's recommendation on Senate File 146, Termination of Parental Rights, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Bill has passed the Committee of the Whole. We are now on Senate File 83. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 83, introduced by Senator Peterson, and act relating to Medicaid, creating the Wyoming Medicaid False Claims Act, authorizing civil recoveries for the state as specified, prescribing duties of the Attorney General, providing procedures, providing for a limitations period and applicability of the Act, providing definitions, prescribing criminal penalties as specified for failure to maintain required records, creating a cause of action for retaliatory employment actions, and providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman, Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred Senate File 83, engrossed Medicaid Fraud Recovery, respectfully report saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representatives Coleman, Filer, Green, Harvey, Kasperic, Larson, Throne, and Wilson. One no vote, Representative Barlow, signed by Representative Harvey, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Vice Chairman Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so the recommendation that Senate File 83 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment, and I ask the good chairwoman from Lovell to introduce the bill and the amendment.
Chairman Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Medicaid fraud is a problem. It's a problem nationwide, and it's a problem in our state. And please pardon me. Somebody came and moved my folder, so I'm trying to move them back. It's estimated that 3 to 10% of all health care spending is lost to fraud. As the baby boom generation continues to age and health expenditures continue to increase, in the absence of adequate prevention methods, the fraud and abuse problem will continue to grow. In 2010, Wyoming budget for Medicaid services was $508.4 million. If Senate File 83 is enacted into law, a 3% recovery in Medicaid funds equals $15 million in savings to the Medicaid program. If you think about the amount of money that we're putting into Medicaid, just to have $15 million inappropriately taken for people who seek to fraud the system. In Kent, a state to the east of us, a couple of states over, they enacted a law just very close to the one that we are bringing before you, the bill that we're bringing before you today. And it went into a law. It went into law in 2009. In 2009, they had zero civil judgments. In 2010, they had 8.5 collected from civil judgments. In 2011, they had 14.7 collected, $14.7 million collected from civil judgments. And in 2012, it jumped to 18.8 collected in civil judgments. So Kansas found a very good solution in how to deal with Medicaid fraud in their state. This is a recreation and an adaptation to our state. If you turn to the bill, it creates the False Claims Act, and it authorizes civil recoveries for the state. It provides the procedures, the duties of the Attorney General, and how they're going to do this, and it also prescribes for criminal penalties. If you go over to page 4, it subjects the person to treble damages, and that means that any person who commits any of the following acts in relation to the Wyoming Medicaid program will be liable to the state for 3 times the amounts of damages which the state sustains because of the acts of that person. And then they also are liable to the state for any civil action. What happens today if Medicaid fraud is discovered is that the federal government gets to recover their portion, but the state does not. And so what we're trying to do is get the state to be able to recover the damages from people who overbill Medicaid. There is a small percentage of people, and the dollar amount is considerably smaller from recipients. But if you go to line 18 of page 4, it says that they knowingly present or causes to be presented a false or fraudulent claim for payment or approval. And then it goes on into false records. It talks about conspiring, fails to disclose a false claim and makes satisfactory arrangements for repayment. So there's multiple parts of this bill, but the bottom line is this. Are we going to spend our Medicaid dollars on legitimate claims from people who have legitimate health issues and providers that submit legitimate claims, or are we going to allow 3 to 10% of our Medicaid budget to go to people who don't have a right for it? So that's really the genesis of this bill. There is a whistleblower protection enactment on page 7 with little b, and that's for anybody who works for an agency that bills Medicaid that discovers that fraud is happening, and this is the protection that is afforded to them. There is a limitation of actions, and it's retroactive. So people are required under this, and that's on page 8, starting on line 12, civil action shall not be brought more than 6 years after the date on which the violation was committed, or more than 3 years after the date when facts material to the right of the action are known. So, and then any action brought under this statute, the state shall be required to prove all of the essential elements of the cause of action, and it's by a preponderance of evidence. And then it goes further to talk about the civil, if there is a guilty verdict rendered, then they are also liable for civil damages. The provisions of this act are not exclusive. The remedies provided in this act shall be in addition to any other remedies provided for in any other law or by common law. It shall be joint and several. And then going on to page 10, it's the definitions, intentional, knowing and knowingly, actual knowledge, deliberate ignorance of the truth or falsifying of information, reckless disregard of the truth. You can see all the things that we're trying to go after. And so I would just commend to you that our Medicaid dollars are better spent. I can tell you that this is not a new bill. It's an old friend. And the day after we failed it, the headlines of the local paper talked about an optometrist who billed an exorbitant amount of money to Medicaid for services that he didn't even have the equipment to supply. And so I think that the problem is real, and I think that it does exist in Wyoming, and I think it's time that we start spending our Medicaid dollars exactly where we decide that they should go and not allow fraudulent activity to dilute the funds or to dilute services to people who really need them. And with that, I'll stand for questions. And, Mr. Chairman, there is not a standing committee amendment.
Thank you. Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a few questions. Over on page 2, or actually it's page 3, in the definitions, and the first question I had was a little confusing as to where you're sticking the definitions. So you got definitions stuck in Chapter 4 of Title 42, but then you go and you stick the same definitions in, they're already in Chapter 4 if when you look on page 10. So you seem to be sticking the definitions, and we usually just, when we do these, we don't normally repeat the definitions in the same chapter. So I was a little confused as to why you're doing that. But my bigger question is, on the definition of knowing and knowingly, which you'll find on page 3, line 8, I get the first one. It says, has actual knowledge of the information. That makes sense, that I had actual knowledge I was defrauding the state Medicaid. The one that, and then C sort of makes some sense, acts in reckless disregard of the truth. I sort of got that. The one that was catching my attention was B, acts in deliberate ignorance. I've prosecuted a lot of ignorant people, but I never knew that was a crime. That one's a new one to me, and so I'm a little confused as to how you determine who's ignorant and who's not ignorant. I can certainly give you a list of who I think, but and what I get is that there's three essential civil actions here, and just so everyone understands this, it's not as if you're not already doing Medicaid fraud. I mean, this has nothing to do with criminal prosecution. This happens quite often. Medicaid fraud comes up. They're criminally prosecuted under our current criminal statutes. This is just dealing with civil penalties so that the person gets their criminal prosecution against them. Now the state's going to come back for the double whammy and actually get money out of them, like a bunch of money, because you get trouble, damages. And the other part that I found interesting, we found this out this year during the interim, there's three different fraud units in the state of Wyoming. And it sort of made sense why they have three different ones, but it sort of seemed like they sort of need to coordinate a little better. There's one in Department of Family Services, and their job in that unit, that fraud unit, is they look at the recipients as to someone says they're poor, and then it turns out they're not poor. Then they have one in Department of Health that the Department of Health one is looking at your doctor. So your doctor or my doctor, trying to determine which of our doctors are the fraudulent doctors. And so that's what Department of Health Fraud Unit does, is just look at the doctors in our communities and figure out which ones are the bad ones and which ones are the good ones. And then over in the Attorney General's office, they have another third fraud unit. So we have three fraud units already operating. The criminal stuff is already moving along nicely. So what I get from this is that on page 4, you'll see on line 18, there's three different causes of action you can do. Knowingly presents or causes to be presented a false claim. So you submit a claim that's false. But again, look at that word knowingly. That's not knowingly like you knew that. It could be that you just were ignorant of what you were doing. And now they can get you. The second one is knowingly makes, uses, or causes to be made or use a false record. I have no idea what that actually means. So I use or cause to be made or used. I don't know if that means I'm submitting it or if I'm just using it. And I'm not sure what I mean by in what manner I'm using it. So the second one's confusing to me. And then the third one, it's my favorite, is a beneficiary of an inadvertent submission of a false claim. So you inadvertently submitted a false claim. And the only thing I can try and figure out what they meant there was you submitted the claim falsely and then you decided that it wasn't false and so now you're trying to pull it back and you didn't tell them within 90 days that you inadvertently tried to defraud them. So the third one confuses me too. And then the fourth one is you conspire to do any of the other three. So I'm just wondering, maybe on second reading, the first one makes sense, knowingly presents a fraudulent claim. I don't have an issue with that. If someone could maybe explain the second one where you're using a claim, and the third one where you're inadvertently submitting a false claim, and then if those don't make sense, maybe we could pull those two out. And then this knowingly, I think we really need to work on. I think some work needs to be done on this bill where we go back and look at the definition of knowingly. I hate to have someone having committed this just through ignorance. Maybe we need to educate people on how to submit the claims. And I'm also confused as to, on the very last part, page 11. So now it's going to be a crime, and the penalty phase is quite interesting. I've never seen one like this. The more money of all your claims, so you take all your claims that you submit, so if you're a doctor and you submit all your claims, if the claims that were false, no, not even the claims that were false, the claims that if you didn't keep good paperwork, if 25% of your paperwork is just poorly maintained, suddenly that's a misdemeanor. And then it goes up from there until you get to a 10-year felony for poorly maintaining your medical records. Boy, I get that you need to maintain your medical records, but I've never seen a 10-year felony for not maintaining your medical records. I think it probably should be a crime. I can understand why they want it to be a crime, because I think it would be hard to prove Medicaid fraud if you don't have the medical records, and that could be a defense the person could use. Hey, well, I just don't have the records. So here we're going to require the person, you got to keep the records. But if you don't keep the records, you may not have committed fraud, you just didn't keep the records. Now it's a 10-year felony. And maybe we should go back and take a look at maybe just making those misdemeanors. I'm not real clear on why we're jumping all the way to a 10-year $10,000 fine or felony. All in all, I'm fine with the bill. The bill makes some sense. I just think it needs some work, and maybe on second reading we can go back and take a look at it. I mean, I'll just give an example just so you know what we're sort of dealing with. I mean, I've done one of these. It doesn't happen much in my county, but I don't know. I guess my doctors are a little different than yours. We just have small country doctors. One of the ones I remember was, you know, those respite care workers where essentially they go into a home and they'll watch a kid with maybe developmental disabilities while the parents go to the movies or something. So it's respite. The respite care worker comes in. They're trained to
to a certain effect up to some emergency stuff, but they don't give therapy or anything. They're usually pretty low-paying jobs, or not real high-paying, because they're not actually given the therapy. They're just doing respite. This young girl was 18, just out of high school, found a good job as a respite care worker, was watching, and used to have to, I don't think they do the same system anymore, but used to have to dial in on the phone the date you did it, the hours you did it. And this young lady, she wasn't the swiftest young lady. She dialed in all the numbers wrong. And suddenly it was Medicaid fraud, and, you know, the whole world's coming down on her and, you know, talking about prison time. And she had her hours a little messed up. We need to be careful when we start talking about this stuff that sometimes it's cases like that that we're dealing with. Now, the optometrist that the good chairman of labor is talking about, yeah, that's good too. But again, remember, you're already doing the criminal part. This bill has nothing to do with the criminal prosecution of Medicaid fraud. What this bill's dealing with is the civil part where you go after treble damages, where you get lots and lots of money for the state of Wyoming, which is a good thing. Yeah, that's a good thing. So the bill is good. I just think there needs to be some work as to the actual language in the bill to make sure that we're getting the people we meant to get and we're not sweeping up the people like I just described to you that you might think second time about. Thank you.
Representative Throne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll respond to a few of the good chairman's comments. First of all, let's talk about the big policy purpose of this statute. What we have are providers receiving hundreds of thousands, perhaps in some cases millions of dollars of state money, and they are knowingly is a high standard, even as defined in this statute, knowingly stealing from the state of Wyoming. That's what we're trying to catch, because we don't have a state false claims or Medicaid fraud act. We don't have the tools to go after this kind of fraud. And some of the cases aren't big enough for the federal government to jump in. So that's the policy need for this statute. And I think the example the good chairman just gave of the young woman who dials in the wrong numbers, that's not knowingly, that's a mistake. Knowingly is you knew you were doing it incorrectly and knew you were doing it wrong and you continue to do it and you continue to collect the state's money. And so then you get to the reason for the treble damages, because you have to have a deterrent, and that's a pretty substantial deterrent. On to some of the specific questions, or at least just a couple of specific points. This, on the civil side, which is the first half of the bill, to establish the civil liability, it creates a new act. So there are definitions that only apply to this Medicaid fraud recovery and this act. So you don't want to put them in the general definition section of the statute, because they don't apply across the board. They just apply here. And that's not unusual statutory construction. It happens from time to time in various acts where you have some general provisions that apply throughout a whole title, and then you have some specific provisions that only apply to a certain part of a law. So that's why the definitions section. And then on the criminal side, I just want to make sure everybody understands, because I didn't understand this the first time I read the bill, that the criminal act is failure to maintain records. And it's not an inadvertent, like I maintain records. No, it's a blatant criminal failure to maintain your records, basically, so you can hide the fraud you're committing. That's the criminal act, and that's what the criminal provision is about. The first part is basically civil liability to recover the money the state has lost and then to impose damages so people are deterred from trying it again.
Representative Greer.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and maybe to the last speaker can probably just a little bit of a follow-up question on the criminal side of this. I'm just wondering what discussion was had with respect to a corporate type of structure, because there are folks within a corporation who have the obligations to follow all the way through. Did, if that was discussed at all, and who is ultimately responsible, and who's going to get thrown in jail in a corporate setting? I just would like a little bit of explanation on that. And then, you know, to the good chair of judiciary, I'm fully aware of the definition of deliberate ignorance, but anyway.
Speaker Lubnow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just some other questions on the act. I believe I agree with the good chairman of judiciary on all of these acts, and as a health care attorney, I appreciate the Health Care Attorney Full Employment Act of 2013, should it pass. My first question is, we already have whistleblower protection in 352910. That says healthcare facilities subject to license pursuant to this act shall not harass, threaten, discipline, or any manner discriminate against any resident, patient, or employee of any healthcare facility for reporting to the division of violation of any state or federal law, rule, or regulation. And so I'm wondering why we need another whistleblower act to cover the whistleblower act that we already have. I guess maybe we could repeal one and have another. The other one is, if you know anything about hospital billing and billing of insurance companies and billing of these patient care codes, you have a diagnosis, it's got a code. It's amazingly complicated, particularly with Medicaid, because you know, the federal government can't do anything simply. The way I read this, if you're a clerk who works for a hospital, as a hospital billing clerk, and you make a mistake on filling those codes out, this doesn't seem to be protective of them. Those hospital clerks, not the hospital who's the beneficiary of the claim, but the way I read this statute, the person who filled out the sheet for the billing for the hospital, or the person who filled out the sheet for the billing for the doctor, or there's another provision in here for beneficiaries, which I guess would be the doctor because the billing clerks do the billing, has to pay it back, and not the people who received the money. And I was wondering how we could fix that. And then are there any consideration for provisions for disgruntled employees? Because making a false report under this statute still doesn't, I mean, it just says any employee, contractor, agent of a person being investigated for violation shall be entitled to all economic damages, and that they can't be discharged, demoted, suspended, threatened, harassed, or in any other matter retaliated against. If somebody makes a bad faith claim to protect their job so that we don't have the disgruntled employee job security act for health care, is there any consideration for amending language in there?
Representative Nicholas.
Thank you. I had to move up here because someone ignorantly removed my device over there, the little yellow guy. So if anyone sees him, let me know. He needs to go home. So I've got a second reading amendment coming up, and I just want to, and I have a couple questions for the bringer of the bill. First of all, if there are penalties assessed federally, because the federal statutes now, you get treble damages if the feds come after you. This would suggest, the way I read it, is that you can get treble damages federally, and then we can bring it and also get treble damages because it's joint and several. So I'd be curious if that's been addressed. And just for information for the floor, the attorney the only people that can bring this action as the bill's currently written is the Attorney General's office. And they have at one time a staff lawyer now who does nothing but enforce Medicaid fraud. And what this does is it helps fund her office, because that treble damages will come back and help, presumably, maybe hire another lawyer and do that process. But in the sense that saying we don't have the tools, we do have the tools now. There's a full-time lawyer that does this nonstop. If they find Medicaid fraud, they go after it. And so all this is a mechanism to create a penalty and to slap people three times the penalty. Plus there are criminal violations. Plus there are additional criminal violations that are added to this. But just briefly, what some of the amendments that I'm thinking about that I may have concerns about. One is the definitions of knowingly. Under this bill, you have to only prove this by a preponderance of evidence. When you prove fraud and you get treble damages, in almost any other aspect of law, you have to show clear and convincing evidence to do that. And so that's, I just think, and I'd like the sponsors' suggestions or comments on that and why it's clear and convincing versus the, or not clear and convincing. And then finally, I really don't understand the penalty portion and how you get to be a 10-year felon. And when I read the language, I have a hard time understanding what that is. So if we can just have an explanation on that, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Representative Connolly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to just talk for a second about the question, somewhat rhetorically, that was brought up. Why do we need this when we have a whistleblower statute under 352910? 352910, which is called Quality Management Functions for Healthcare Facilities, Confidentiality, Immunity, Whistleblowing, and Peer Review, has in it kind of numerous sections regarding whistleblowing. But years ago, I think it was my first term, I brought an amendment to modified this statute so that it had a remedy to it. Right now, this statute has absolutely no teeth to it. And so when an individual attempts to bring forth a claim, there's no remedy. There is no pointing to our Government Frauds Act, which would be necessary in order to make this whistleblowing statute meaningful. Right now, it's not meaningful. So we need this bill in order to have a meaningful remedy, as you see in this bill. Thank you.
Chairman Harvey.
And I promise the majority floor leader this would be a short one. Okay, fraud units. Department of Family Services is partially charged with screening out recipients who are not eligible for Medicaid services. They do not have any enforcement authority except turning down services. The Department of Health has authority over the fraudulent acts of providers. That is not just doctors. That is many, multiple, myriad of providers, people who provide home health care, people who provide respite care for children with disabilities, people who provide waiver services, people who provide speech, language, occupational, physical therapy. It's a myriad of providers, and they are able to bill through multiple channels. Both the Department of Family Services and the Department of Health rely on the AG's office, the fraud unit, and it does have one attorney and two legal aides. Definitions. Deliberate ignorance. I can tell you about that one. It is when you receive a notice or an update from Medicaid that says, from now on, this billing code will be X, or that way to describe something will be Y, or this is how you fill out the form. Here are the new forms you need to fill out. Here is how you bill. Deliberate ignorance is when you do not read the memos, when you do not educate yourself and you do not keep up. And I know that there are tons of billing codes, and I know that this is a complicated system because I used to be a provider, and I quit because of how complicated the system became. The definition of false record, that would be the case of the optometrist. He just simply said that he did things that he did not do. Inadvertent submissions would be more like you hit the button again, and now suddenly you have billed three times. Or it could be involving kickbacks to where you do hit the button more than once with a reciprocity agreement. I think that this bill could use a little bit of work, and I'm really happy that I have so many good attorneys on this floor to help with that. We've been working on one that has now turned into a second reading amendment, and you'll be seeing that tomorrow. The point is this. Let's keep this bill moving. Let's get something on the books, and we have two more readings to fix it. If we do not get anything on the books, how much money will be lost in the next biennium? Because I can tell you that we've already lost close to $20 million over the last 2 years because we did nothing. So I'd prefer to do something and tweak it along the way than do nothing and just keep allowing the money to go down the drain. Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to add a few sentences from my perspective because we have heard from a lot of lawyers who are very good at getting their clients off. In my previous healthcare career, I worked as a medical records administrator out in the land of fruits and nuts on the West Coast. And I think this is a very good bill. When you see a patient for a respiratory infection and you bill for pneumonia, that's not an honest mistake. That's fraud. That's stealing money from the state. That's stealing money from patients who might be able to get care if there were any money left, but you took it. When you send in bills for things that you didn't do, when you falsely claim pneumonia but you don't write it down in a record, when you don't keep records for the 6 years that you're required to keep them in Wyoming, that's not a mistake. That's fraud. That's stealing money from patients, from the state, and with all due respect to my lawyers all around me, don't let those lawyers get those people off. Keep this bill moving.
Representative Barlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Some of you noticed that I voted no out of committee, and I wanted to explain that a little bit. What you heard on this floor as testimony is that we can improve this bill. There were attempts, there was an effort in committee. It's a very complex bill, has a lot of moving parts. So, just so we know, a new definition of deliberate ignorance, that is voting for fraud. I didn't vote for fraud. I voted for the opportunity to keep this moving forward, and we can address many of the concerns that you have. So please vote aye.
Sensing that we would like to vote, question has been called on Senate File 83. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Senate File 83 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Representative Barlow.
Mr. Chairman, privilege of the floor.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the body, with us today, traveling from the northeast corner, is the Gillette Area Leadership Institute, with Kay French and all of the participants. So if they would stand, let's welcome them to the House.
The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 84, Wyoming Health Insurance Pool Premiums. Will the reader please read the bill?
Senate File Number 84 is introduced by Senator Scott, an act relating to insurance, freezing premiums for the Wyoming Health Insurance Pool as specified, and providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman, Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred Senate File 84 engrossed, Wyoming Health Insurance Pool Premiums, respectfully reports same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representatives Barlow, Coleman, Filer, Green, Harvey, Kasperic, Larson, and Wilson, one excused, Representative Throne, signed by Representative Harvey, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Vice Chairman Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 84 do pass. And I would ask Madam Chairman Harvey to give the explanation of the bill.
Chairman Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. After the last one, I'm a little facing this one with a little trepidation. But I can just tell you it's a short-term fix. Right now we have a Wyoming health insurance pool, and it is to cover people who cannot get insurance in any other way. It covers people from ages 12 to 65. It has an average premium of $900 per month per person. And so what this bill proposes to do is stabilize the rates in the pool during this period of unrest. It has guaranteed issue as mandated by the federal government during an open, well, right now it has guaranteed issue during an open enrollment period. The age rating provisions are going to be raising. All right, I better go back to the bill. What we're trying to do is freeze the premiums for the Wyoming Health Insurance Pool, and it is until, for the period of July 1st of 13 until June 30th of 15, and that will be the sunset date of the health insurance pool altogether. If you go on to page 2 of the bill, beginning July 1st of 07, and it's on line 4, except as provided in subsection E of this section, there will be two levels of eligibility. This is already in the law. Level 1 applies to persons with income equal to or greater than 250% of the federal poverty guidelines. Level 2 eligibility applies to persons with income below 250% and down to Medicaid. Premium rates for level 1 eligibility shall be set at 150% to 200% of rates applicable to individual standard risks. That's where the trouble comes in. We don't know what that standard risk is going to be. We don't know what is going to happen to insurance rates because of ACA. And so what we're trying to do is freeze these rates, and the difference will be paid for by the surcharge that's put on health insurance companies today that make up the difference in what it costs to serve these people. And so just for that period of July 1st, 2013 through June 30th of 15, then the premium rates will stay what shall be as provided in subsection E of this. And that still sets the rates. So here are some of the reasons that we want these people to go into the market gradually. And one is to stabilize rates in the pool during this unrest period of time. We want guaranteed issue during an open enrollment. The new age rating provisions are going to raise the rates in the risk pool as well. The new regulations will allow up to 50% rate increase for people who smoke. There will be restrictions on co-pays and deductibles. There are a lot of mandates that are coming in, such as mental health parity. There's going to be more cost shifting for Medicaid. And the exchange itself is going to create unknown risks. Subsidies, this is going to, the subsidies, I'm going to leave that one out. So what we're really hoping to do is these people who cannot get insurance today, we want them to continue to be able to get insurance. It is a very high premium insurance, but we don't want those premiums to be unstable and actually increase even further. So this is a short-term fix for a short-term problem. We just like to stabilize the rates for a short period of time. I'll stand for any questions.
Seeing no discussion, question has been called. We're voting on Senate File 84. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The bill has passed the Committee of the Whole. We are now on Senate File 147. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 147 is introduced by Senator Kraft, an act relating to public health and hospitals, providing for designation by the Department of Health of hospitals as centers for heart attack and stroke care as specified, providing designation criteria, granting rulemaking authority, and providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman, Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred Senate File 147, engrossed stroke and heart attack treatment centers, respectfully report same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Those voting aye, Representatives Barlow, Coleman, Filer, Green, Harvey, Kasperic, Larson, Throne, and Wilson, signed by Representative Harvey, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 147 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee amendment, and I will turn the explanation of both the bill and the amendment over to this great lady behind me from the land of the camels.
Representative Kasperic.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill is a friendly bill, an easy bill. I know you haven't heard that from me before, have you? Okay, what this one does, and to give you some background on it, about a year ago, the American Heart Association announced a wonderful new program that provided about $7.1 million for called Project to Improve Heart Attack Care in Wyoming. And this was supported by national and state trusts and foundations and organizations. And what it did is it allowed the coordination for emergency care related to heart attacks and strokes among all of our emergency medical services, our first responders, and our hospitals. So it helped to coordinate that they had the equipment necessary, that the hospitals had the protocols in place that would help people survive those critical minutes when they first have a heart attack or stroke. So that was the 1 year ago background. What this bill does, it allows for the Department of Health to actually designate and post on their website what hospitals are part of that criteria. And you all would have received a sheet of paper that looks like this, that gives you that criteria, and it says stroke and STEMI designations, and I know that you're all just dying to hear me tell you what STEMI stands for, aren't you? Okay, that is ST elevation myocardial infarction. So, now that there are no questions on that, what that means is that a cardiogram is taken, and it shows acute changes of the heart being damaged, and without immediate treatment within the first hour, within the first couple of hours, you know, the person will suffer a full-blown heart attack with heart damage. And the whole goal of this is to help prevent that from becoming a permanent change. So if you look at this sheet, on the left side, it talks about strokes. And strokes are designated as either comprehensive stroke centers, not stroke centers, and it provides for highly specialized treatment for patients who suffer from the most complex strokes or stroke complications. So these are people who've had a really serious stroke, and we want those people to go to a center that can give them that comprehensive care that they need. And the primary stroke center is a facility that makes exceptional efforts to foster better outcomes for stroke care. Excuse me. So achieving the certification means that they have the services provided, the critical elements to achieve long-term success in improving outcomes. And again, you know, this is a designation that will allow patients to have the best outcomes if they have suffered a stroke. Under the heart attack section on the right side, it designates receiving centers and referring centers. And a receiving center would be a hospital or facility that has a cardiac cath lab that can take these patients who have cardiogram changes and are in the process of having a heart attack, and they can administer a percutaneous coronary intervention, which means that they can insert, you know, via catheter a little balloon that will help to open up that clogged artery and limit or actually remove any chance of a heart attack that patient may have. A referring center is a hospital or facility that may not, it won't have a cardiac cath lab that can do the mechanical means of treating, but it will be able to administer clot-busting medications that will help the clot that has formed to resolve. And that gives the patient more time to get to a receiving center for more comprehensive care. So that's some background on what this is about and what this bill does. It allows for the designation by the Department of Health of hospitals as centers for heart attack and stroke care specified. It'll set up the designation criteria, which is already done through the sheet that you've received, grant rulemaking authority, and provide when this can start. If you go down to A, they'll establish rules and regulations for the process for recognition and designation of hospitals. And if you turn over to page 2, lines 2 through 8, again, just list out those heart attack, receiving, referring centers, comprehensive stroke, and primary stroke centers. In section B, the designation of hospitals shall recognize those hospitals that are accredited. And they're accredited by the Society for Cardiovascular Patient Care, the American Heart Association, and the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations. And there may be another accrediting agency that will meet all of the criteria that was set forth in the study and in the program that could be recognized, but the department will have to set up the rules for that. Under C, it allows for the department to withdraw designation of a hospital if they are no longer in conformity with that designation. And when you go on to D, they'll adopt rules and regulations that will, on line 8, specify criteria for qualification. Line 12, designate application procedures. And line 14, designate procedures to remove that designation. On line 17, and this I'll get into some of the standing committee amendments, but this will allow the department to support for the coordination among designated hospitals. They won't have any really part in making that coordination happen, but just through their listing of the hospitals will support that action. So if you go to the standing committee amendment, there are some just some minor changes on page 2, line 19. Will delete, may suspend or revoke, and insert shall withdraw. Page 3, line 1, and there will be a committee of the whole amendment that further clarifies this. This is a clerical correction that didn't completely get taken care of in the standing committee amendment. But it will, what this does is attempts to eliminate the need for using the Wyoming Administrative Procedure Act to develop these rules. Page 3, line 14, we will delete grounds and delete revocation or and insert withdrawal. And then page 3, line 15, delete suspension and insert page 3, line 17, delete provision and insert support. So unless there are questions on the standing committee amendment, I would ask for the question on that.
You've heard the explanation of the Standing Committee Amendment 1 to Senate File 147. Seeing no discussion on that, question has been called. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment passes the committee of the whole. We have another committee of the whole amendment, number one. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move committee of the whole amendment number one to Senate File 147. Essentially, brothers and sisters, what we're doing is removing the appeal process through the Wyoming Administrative Procedure Act, since essentially what the Department of Health is doing is giving a rubber stamp approval from some outside organization, whether it be the Society of Cardiovascular Patient Care, American Heart Association, or JCO. We thought it was inappropriate to have the Wyoming Administrative Procedure Act pertain to the bill. So essentially what we're doing is eliminating on page 3, lines 1 and 2. And I'll stand for any questions.
Representative Patton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would one of the counselors help us out a little bit in giving us a little discussion as to the authority that we're taking away from the procedure and imposing something that is going to be administratively unchallengeable? I think this is going a little bit too fast by just saying that we dislike or distrust the Procedures Act and thus can do away with it. I'd like a little clearer explanation of what you're doing and why you're...
Representative Thrawn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll go ahead and answer the good representative from Sheridan County's question. Essentially, the amendment just introduced really should have been included as part of the committee amendment. It's really a cleanup amendment. The APA kicks in when the agency's acting in a licensing function. Due process, notice and hearing and all those things sort of kick in. And so the language is inappropriate here because the Department of Health is not exercising a licensing function. These outside agencies will give the accreditation or not give the accreditation, and the Department of Health will sort of coordinate that information. So the Department of Health isn't actually the body that grants the designation, so therefore they really couldn't be held accountable if it was withdrawn. It's more of a ministerial function, so you don't want all those licensing procedures to kick in. And really, I apologize for this. I could have sworn I took this out in committee, but I guess I didn't.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple of questions that I'll be raising as this moves along. But my first question is, who pays for the accreditation? I know many rural Wyoming hospitals don't seek JCO accreditation because it's horribly expensive. How much would an accreditation cost by the American Heart Association or the American Stroke Association? Would there be a break for Wyoming hospitals in seeking these accreditations or at least deferring part of the cost? And if a hospital in Wyoming does not seek accreditation, will their heart attack and stroke patients be referred? Thank you.
We haven't voted on the committee of the whole amendment, and would there be?
We call the question.
Question being called. We are voting on committee of the whole amendment number one to Senate File 147. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment passes the committee of the whole. We are back on the bill. Chairman Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
what I'm trying to do with this is to figure out the downside to this. You know, we've got the advantages pretty well outlined to us, but I guess when I read 35-2-1001 A and C, you know, the Department of Health needs to establish rules. The Department of Health is involved in suspending or revoking designations. Do we have any liability if we do something like this for mistakes and evaluations? I mean, do we have a cause of action that could go against us for assigning the qualifications of some hospital? And another thing, I guess, is kind of related to that. Do we have any long-term fiscal obligations? Do we have a battery of workers over there that could go out and do whatever monitoring has to be done to see if the rules that we've set up are being abided by? I guess I don't know right now how much monitoring is going to be involved, what liability we have, why this association doesn't just do it on their own without us. And I guess that's my issues right now. I think maybe we've done these kind of things before, but I'd sure like to know more about it before I vote.
Representative Kasparik.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, the designation is already being done by the American Heart Association. What they have done is they've established what best practices are in the care of patients who have strokes, in the care of patients who have heart attack. And the designation is already being done through the coordination of this grant process. It's a 3-year grant process. What the Department of Health is doing is just giving kind of a depository, a list of which hospitals have what designation. So the rules that they are creating are just how to receive that information from the accrediting organizations, how to and to list it, how to receive information if a hospital falls out of designation, if they're no longer eligible for the designation, to remove their name from the list. This is just to give a place where citizens can go and see where hospitals in their communities or in their areas or within the state are able to offer the kind of care that they might need depending on what their need is. There was an earlier question about who pays for it. It's not so much a who pays for it. Hospitals decide to be accredited or not to be accredited based on a lot of other things. But the criteria for what best practice is what we're actually looking at in determining the designation.
Chairman Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In response to that, I'm looking at page 2, line 19, where it says the department may suspend or revoke or the designation of a hospital pursuant to subsection A, which is on the previous page. And if the department determines that a hospital is not in compliance with the requirements of this section or rules, and it goes on to say these other things as well, and I need to be convinced that doesn't involve some money and possible appeals and things like that.
Representative Lauchs.
Mr. Speaker, in response to a question asked by the good House representative from District 40, I had the same question earlier on why was it necessary, as long as these designations are being made by an outside group, why is it necessary for the bill? And I was told it was necessary basically to give our health department instructions in order to recognize that accreditation. And that's what I had. Thank you.
Representative Kasparik.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the good chairman's question, the one section we referred to on page 2, lines 19, that was addressed to some degree with the House Standing Committee amendment. It now reads, the department shall withdraw designation of a hospital pursuant to subsection A. And again, all they're doing is receiving information to post the names of the designated hospitals and setting up a rule for how they receive information to remove. The department assures us that this is not a problem for the department to create this list. And again, it's a list so that citizens of Wyoming know that what hospitals have what designation. So again, it's just a matter of listing information for people to be able to see it and to know what hospitals are able to provide what care. The criteria and the designation are made through the grant process that is already in place and already occurring in the state of Wyoming. So unless there are other questions.
Representative Barlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and for this bill, ladies and gentlemen of this House, information is power, and power saves lives in this instance. So I would ask you to vote favorably for this bill because this gets information to people to save lives. Thank you.
Is there any other discussion? Are you ready for the question? Question being called, we are voting on Senate File 147. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Bill 147 has passed Committee of the Whole. We are now on Senate File 80, State Auditor Employee Method Amendments. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 80, as introduced by Senator Netting, an act relating to duties of the state auditor, providing additional methods for paying state employees, allowing flexibility in the disclosure of pay and wage information to all state employees by electronic means, modifying the date of final pay for state employees whose employment terminates, and providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman, Committee Number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred, Senate File 80, State Auditor Employee Payment Method Amendments, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representatives Blickery, Eklund, Goggles, Kirkbride, Laux, Madden, Northrup, Petroff, and Semlich, signed by Representative Madden, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Madden?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, to do so with the recommendation that Senate File 80 do pass, and there are no amendments. I further would ask the co-sponsor, Representative Burkhart, to explain the bill.
Representative Burkhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 80 is an efficiency bill for the state auditor's office. The bill changes some of the things to allow them to be much more efficient in how they pay state employees. And as the bill was described, it does three things. It allows the state auditor to use different methods to pay state employees. This bill would allow direct deposits to be made, warrants to be issued, or credit or debit cards to be used. Cards are an up-and-coming way of making payments to employees for pay. There are some employees who don't have a bank account, who don't want a bank account, but still need to handle their money. Those cards allow for that method of payment, along with electronic fund transfers and those sorts. In the bill, if the auditor elects to use those cards, if employees want them, there'll be a contract with a card issuing company and require that that company allow one or more transactions to withdraw money from that card without any charge to the employee. They don't lose any money doing that. Also, that card cannot be used as a true credit card. You can't issue credit on it, and it can't be used for overdrafts. Excuse me. The second part of the bill
allows the State Auditor's Office to issue the information required for employee payroll in one of several forms, either in writing or electronic form or another method that is used by the State Auditor. Currently, the State Auditor has to print paper copies of the pay advice, your pay stub, so to speak. This would allow them to use that format in electronic means, so that if you're traveling, you're off work for one reason or another, you just aren't at work, you don't have to worry about it showing up in the mail. You can go onto a computer, you can log in with your password, and find out what's in your paycheck, what the pay was, what the deductions were, and all of that. Currently, that's used by most private industry, and it makes it very efficient. I know I work under such a system, and when I'm over here, I can check payroll with no problems at all on a website without having to wait to get the mail. The third portion is to allow the State Auditor's Office to pay employees who terminate for one reason or another on the normal pay cycle, excuse me, to allow them to be paid as they would get their normal paycheck without issuing a separate check to them and it's just the normal cycle. The reason for all of this is efficiencies. Currently in the auditor's office, they have the ability to do all of this. This would take no additional funding, no additional money or equipment. It would just take some programming that they're already capable of doing, and make it much more efficient. The State Auditor's Office is looking for those efficiencies because really it's one of those state agencies funded or staffed with very little in the way of equipment in those areas. It's all personnel. The last thing is a question keeps coming up about the effective date. They would like the effective date to be as stated July 1st of 2013. And that gives them an opportunity to educate people, train people, including their staff and the state employees. Really does improve the efficiency, allows the State Auditor's Office to come up to current standards with payroll and those things. And with that, I would stand for questions.
Seeing no more discussion, we're ready for the question. We're voting on Senate File 80. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Senate File 80 has passed the Committee of the Whole. We are now on Senate File 29. Will the reading clerk read the bill?
Senate File 29 is introduced by Senator Christensen, an act relating to motor vehicles, eliminating prohibition on soliciting rides on highways and providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman of Committee 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, to whom was referred Senate File 29, Hitchhiking, respectfully report saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representatives Blake, Blevins, Campbell, Laux, McKim, Dave Zwanitzer. Those who voted no, Representative Hutchings, Yeagy, and Reeder, signed by Representative David Zwanitzer, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Zwanitzer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 29 do pass. And I'm going to turn this hitchhiking bill over to the great representative that's looking to catch a free ride.
Representative Petroff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As the reader mentioned, this bill is eliminating the prohibition on soliciting rides on highways. Highways, as defined in this statute, is highways or streets. And we already allow people to walk on streets and highways. We're just going to allow them to stick out their thumb and look for a ride. Hitchhiking first became popular in World War II, and it was considered a patriotic duty to pick up soldiers as they were walking along the roads. It became demonized in the 60s and 70s as hippies and beatniks were trying to get to demonstrations, and the FBI did a big campaign to try to discourage hitchhiking and try to encourage laws against hitchhiking. There's a lot of hitchhiking going on in a lot of our communities. In my community, skiers use it to get to backcountry areas, particularly where there isn't a lot of parking. We use it in the summer if we're round-trip hiking or fishing and trying to get from one place to another. Towns and cities can still pass their own rules prohibiting hitchhiking. If there's a freeway ramp or if you're near a correction facility and it's not an appropriate place to have hitchhiking, towns and cities can still pass their own rules. There is a handout on your desk with a colorful map, and that map indicates what some other states are doing with regard to hitchhiking. The red are states where hitchhiking is illegal. The blue and green are places where it's legal except on freeways and off-paved sections of the road. The yellow is there are other laws for hitchhiking, and the white is where hitchhiking is legal on the shoulder of all roads, and that's where this bill is trying to take us, to be a white state on this map. There was some testimony in the committee from law enforcement agencies. The sheriffs and the chiefs didn't have a problem with the bill. The Highway Patrol and peace officers did have a problem, but their main opposition with it was that they wouldn't have probable cause to pull people over and stop them and ask them what they were up to. They could still stop, though, and do welfare checks. With that, I guess it looks like there's at least one question out there, so I'll stop for questions.
Representative Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have a question. I bet you wish I did, but... I just think it's ironic that we're having this conversation today, and I'm not real sure what the need is. That's my main concern. You know, most of our parents told us as growing up that we shouldn't pick up hitchhikers. I'm not sure it's a safe thing that we should encourage people to do. If this is being brought so that skiers can get to the top of the hill in one community in our state, I would suggest it's probably not something we need to do.
Representative Croker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm on and for this bill, and if there's not a need, my question would be, why do we need to have a need for the government to be able to tell us what we can or can't do? I mean, I don't pick up hitchhikers, and I won't pick up hitchhikers more than likely if this bill passes, but I don't see why that should be the government's choice and not my own. And that's what this bill about is individual freedom. And if you don't want to pick up hitchhikers, don't pick up hitchhikers. But I don't see a need for the government to make it a requirement.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am on and in favor of this bill. I worry that if we don't pass it, those of us who compulsively do pick up hitchhikers could be found liable for some crime as well. And in my community, often the hitchhiker's car is in the shop for a couple of days, and no one hesitates to pick one up.
Representative Nicholas.
Thank you. Rising on and in favor of the bill, I've hitchhiked to Arizona, I've hitchhiked to Maine, and I've hitchhiked to Oregon. When I worked at the energy at the uranium mine in Jeffrey City, and hitchhiked to work almost every other day, and that's just the way I got around. And I still, you know, I kind of drive by, kind of look them over, and if they look like good folks, I pick them up. And the idea that it's against the law just doesn't make sense to me. And so, in favor of the bill.
Majority Floor Leader Brown.
Mr. Chairman, there is a need for this bill. If you're a skier, you know what it is.
Is there any more discussion? Question having been called, all those in favor of Senate File 29 do say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Senate File 29 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File... Representative Wilson, privilege.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Speaker of the floor, or privilege of the floor. Thank you. I would like to apologize to my fellow legislators who are attorneys for my reckless disregard of proper floor procedure. I was trying to be smart, and I guess I wasn't. So I hope you will all forgive me.
We forgive you.
Privilege. Okay. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 75, Honor Farm Horse Program. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File Number 75, introduced by Senator Hicks, an act relating to state institutions, specifying that state correctional facilities may only use wild horses from within the state as specified, providing an exception, requiring a report, and providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman, in Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State and Public Lands and Water Resources, to whom was referred Senate File 75 engrossed Honor Farm Horse Program, respectfully report same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Those who voted aye, Representatives Blake, Campbell, Eklund, Greer, Hunt, McKim, Simlick, Winters, Danswanitzer, signed by Representative Simlick, Chairman.
Representative Simlick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 75 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. I will quickly explain the Standing Committee Amendment, which was an inaccurate citation of a reference in the bill. Instead of referencing the inspection of brands at the time of delivery and a change of ownership of animals, it instead had cited the application for brands. So that is the Standing Committee Amendment. And Mr. Chairman, I would call for the question on the Standing Committee Amendment. I think it's pretty minor.
Question being called. You're voting on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 75. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment has passed the Committee of the Whole. We're on the bill, back on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I would turn the explanation of the bill over to the good representative from the land of the Green River.
Representative Blake.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen of the 62nd, I bring you Senate File 75, which is the Honor Farm Horse Program. If you don't know, they train wild Mustangs and I guess a burro every once in a while up at the Honor Farm and Center part of the state. And what we want to do is make sure, if you look at your bill on page 2, line 18, the program shall not use any wild horse which was not initially captured or found within the boundaries of the state. That's the meat of the bill, and I might add this could possibly cut down on hitchhiking. Please call for the question.
Representative Waters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to ask the bringer of the bill on page 3, line 4, 5, and 6, it discusses taking possession of 8 horses from outside the state, which seems to be, although it's referenced to the previous page, it still seems to be contradictory. Wondering what's going on there.
Representative Blake.
I don't know if I can answer that or not, but sometimes there was testimony that there is a certain outfitter that likes a certain color of horse to go in his pack string, and he requests that kind of horse, and they may not have it in the corrals down by where I live. There's a huge BLM, the Bureau that manages our lands. They may not have those in stock. That's what we were told in committee, that sometimes they request certain colors, certain type of horse.
Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I can shed some light on this subject. I'm a co-sponsor on the bill, and what this all stems from, as most of you probably know, is that As a result of the Wild Horse Ante Bill of 1972, the bureau that manages our lands is charged with maintaining and controlling those herds of horses that are in designated horse management areas, which are all over the West. Most of them in Nevada, but a lot here in Wyoming. Wyoming, as you probably also remember, is the only state of those states impacted by these wild horse herds that currently has a consent decree with the federal government, which is requiring the federal government to maintain the appropriate management level of horses on these horse management areas. That consent decree is about to expire, which was part of the reason for the bringing of this bill, because the federal agency has made it known that they have no intentions of renewing that consent decree. So basically what we have here is a federal agency that is charged with maintaining the proper number of horses on these horse management areas. They double in population every 4 years. They get out of hand really quickly. The federal government has their hands tied by all kinds of rules and regulations that says that these horses cannot be sold. They can only be adopted out. And, of course, we've got 45,000 of them now standing in corrals and long-term holding pastures at taxpayer expense, I might mention. More horses standing in pastures and corrals on taxpayer expense than they actually have running on the federal lands. About 75% of their budget, in fact, is spent taking care of horses that are not on BLM lands. In the federal laws and rules and regulations, they have a bunch of stipulations that says that outfits like the Border Patrol or other agencies that might have need of horses for performing their duties can only get those horses from these BLM wild horse programs. And which, I'll just make a little sidetrack, is in direct competition with private enterprise, just saying. But nonetheless, the reason that the Senate decided to put on this amendment, which allowed for these eight horses from outside the state of Wyoming, is because the Border Patrol or these other agencies do occasionally come and they want a specific kind and style of horse that they apparently can't find in the thousands of horses that they really ought to be getting off of the range in Wyoming. And so they put this amendment in. So personally, I would kind of say that that's an unnecessary component of this bill, and maybe the House could do something a little different than the Senate did.
Representative Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And 45,000 horses is a lot of dog food, but I don't understand why we're getting involved at this level with this. I haven't heard a good justification for it.
Representative Wallace.
Sorry, I was having to listen with both ears and not doing a very good job of either one. But I think your question was just simply, why are we doing this? And that is because currently at the Honor Farm, we have this program where the inmates are training these horses, and they're bringing these horses in from all over the country. So basically what we're saying with this bill is that if you're going to train horses at the Honor Farm, which we think is a pretty good thing for inmates to be doing, and probably as reasonable a thing as we legally can do under the current situation, that if they're going to be doing it, they at least ought to be doing it for horses that are taken off the ranges in Wyoming, and that we shouldn't be training horses that are coming out of Nevada or California.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As somebody that doesn't know very much about horses, but when people get tired of feeding these horses and fixing up corrals that have kicked apart and get bored with them, and they turn them loose, and they're somewhere out on the range, and if they're not a gelding, how do you tell that they're not a wild horse or a domestic horse? And we use wild horse a lot, and that's something that I've never understood, because I think the feedstock for some of those that are roaming around there are just abandoned horses as opposed to wild horses.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wallace.
That would be a correct assumption. And, in fact, the evolution of the so-called wild horse of the American West is almost completely and totally from the farm and ranch horses that were turned out in the 1940s. You recall that in the 40s, a couple of things happened. We had World War II, and at almost exactly the same time, John Deere was taking over the country. And partly because of the war, you couldn't hire anybody to drive your teams or do that kind of work, so everybody went out and bought a tractor. And as a result, all those stud bunches that ranches had been maintaining for their hay teams and their saddle horses, they had no longer had any need for them, and they just quit gathering them. And so almost all of those horses are really just feral horses, nothing more than that. And today, because of the serious situation in the horse industry writ large and the down economy, people that can't afford their horses are doing exactly what you mentioned, and they're turning them out. If they've got a brand or some other signifying thing that can prove that they weren't originally a feral horse, then our state agencies have some recourse. But so long as they are standing on that horse management area and they do not have a brand on them, then the assumption is that they belong to the federal government.
Is there further discussion? Question being called. We're voting on Senate File 75. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Senate File 75 has passed the Committee of the Whole. We are now on Senate File 90, Administrative Control, Acquired Institutional Lands. The reading clerk will read the bill, please.
Senate File 90 is introduced by Senator Vidal, an act relating to state lands, providing for the management and control of certain institutional lands by the Board of Land Commissioners as specified, providing definitions, providing that the Director of the Office of State Lands shall determine the best use for acquired institutional lands managed by the Board of Land Commissioners as specified, requiring a report, providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman, Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State and Public Lands and Water Resources, to whom was referred, Senate File 90, engrossed, Administrative Control of Acquired Institutional Lands, respectfully report saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Those who voted aye, Representatives Blake, Campbell, Eklund, Greer, Hunt, McKim, Semlich, Winters, and Dan Zwanenser, signed by Representative Semlich, Chairman.
You heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Semlich?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that Senate File 90 do pass. And I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. I know sometimes when we ask you to approve a Standing Committee Amendment without a lot of explanation, it is rather sometimes disconcerting to you. So let me try to do this real quick so we can get it out of the way. This Senate File 90 has to do with three of our state departments. So you'll see in the Standing Committee Amendment that the amendment deletes and changes some words and adds some. It does that in triplicate, three different times. So it has to do, one, with adding school lands, it adds school trust lands, and it changes the such to these. So the amendment is rather benign for the most part. And then there's a reporting requirement that the information that comes out of this bill goes to the Agricultural State Public Lands and Water Resources Interim Committee. So that's basically, that is the amendment. And if there's no questions on the amendment, I would call for the question, and we'll get it out of the way. Then we'll turn the sponsorship over the bill to a colleague here in just a moment.
Is there discussion on this amendment? We're voting on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 90. All of those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment has passed the Committee of the Whole. We're back on the bill. Chairman Semlich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And now I will turn the explanation of Senate File 90, Administrative Control of Acquired Institutional Lands, over to our good colleague from House District 28.
Representative Winters.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. This bill, I'm pleased to bring it to you, is a result of a study that was called for during the last session. And what it was calling for was an assessment of all of our institutional lands, which had not been inventoried and, unfortunately, this body lost track of through the years. We received the report in August. And now that we have it, what we're doing with this bill is we feel that it's best to try to aggregate the control of those lands under a board, specifically the Land Commissioner's Board. As I walk you through the bill, really it falls into three parts. They're just duplications of one another. The first part starts on page number 2, and it speaks to the Department of Health. The bottom of page number 3 speaks to the Department of Family Services. The bottom of page number 5 begins to speak toward the Department of Corrections. And here's what the bill does. We'll look back at page number 2. You'll see here on line number 4 that the Board of Land Commissioners shall direct, subject to limitations contained in the Constitution of the State, applicable state and federal laws and conveyance instruments, the control, leasing, exchange, care, and disposal of all acquired institutional lands not directly utilized for departmental purposes. Now, that's a key line right there. If you'll look down at line number 12, any amount received from transactions involving such lands shall be credited to a special revenue fund created for the Department of Health to be used upon further legislative appropriation for major maintenance or capital construction at the institution for which the land was required, unless otherwise directed by state or federal law or the conveyance instrument. The reason for this, the testimony in our committee was that the Senate felt that these lands were acquired for that specific institution and that the monies that would be received if they decided to sell a portion of that institutional land to an outside entity should be kept within the institution. Obviously, all of this has to go through the Board of Land Commissioners, and these are for surplus properties only. If in any way they are used by that department, if they have a departmental purpose, they cannot shed off. And we heard a report from one of these institutions. Two out of the three directors supported this bill of these institutions we were speaking of the other day. But from one of them, we heard a report that there's a section of land that they have no need of, no use for, and if they were able to allow that land to go and find another piece of land in exchange for it, or take the funds received from it and utilized for capital improvements on their grounds, they would find it very profitable. And so toward the end of the bill, let me move on here. Toward the end of the bill, page number 7, you see the duties of the director and who they are to report to. On line number 18, page 7, the board shall have authority to override any decision made by the director upon such terms and conditions as shall be established by the board. In addition to the powers enumerated in this section, the director shall have authority. And then it goes through the director's authority on page number 8. And so this is the meat of the bill. And, Mr. Chairman, I'll stand for any questions.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just a couple questions for the bringer of the bill. Does this allow us or prevent us from closing a facility completely as opposed to just partially? And then what happens if we shut down a facility completely? Where does that funding go?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Winters.
Thank you. Mr. Representative, that is well without outside the scope of this particular bill. This only has to do with the disposal of lands that are not being utilized for departmental purposes.
Representative Green.
Right. So a follow-up there, Mr. Chairman. So what happens if a department wants to close a facility? This doesn't apply to it at all then, am I understanding?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Winters.
Thank you. If a department wanted to close a facility, that would be brought as a completely separate bill and would come before this body in a different manner altogether. This is only speaking to a very specific instance in which portions of land not being utilized by those facilities can be sold or repurposed.
Representative Green.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize for I'm not being clear. So if we have a facility, the department no longer wants to use that facility, no wants to use that land at all. So they want to... I guess the next person will answer my question. Thanks.
Yeah, go for it, man.
Representative Greer.
Mr. Chairman, sorry, I was in a little lawyer's room. Okay, if you read the bill carefully, what it says is that the state lands is going to take oversight over those lands not being directly used by the department for their facilities. And so in my neck of the woods, we have a facility that is a campus that's located. And then all around it are state lands, but they're institutional lands. And it's farm ground. It's being leased out right now. And then across the highway, there's some strips of land that are not used for anything. And so the concept here is instead of having the agency or the department, or in this case the institution, have to manage and oversee those lands, that's going to be done by the board, state lands and state lands investment, excuse me. And what will happen is each of the divisions or each of the agencies will make their recommendations on those lands and what they desire to do with them. And in the particular case that I'm thinking of, there's probably some of those lands that make sense to get those sold. And then those funds and the terms was used will be earmarked, but they'll go back for the agency's usage. But this will not affect, by the language of the bill, that land that is being used by the institution. So hopefully that answers the question that was posed.
Speaker Lubnow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My concern, and I think we can handle it with an amendment, I'm not sure. What I'm worried about is if we sell a portion of our state lands to multi-billionaire Bob, who lives across the street and wants to buy it, do we create a slush fund for our agencies so that they can build their own facilities in consideration of their own needs without having to come through us so that we can appropriate the dollars?
Representative Greer.
Oh.
Chairman Semlick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We did have quite a little discussion about that, but to answer the good speaker's question, the protection in that I think is found at least within on page 2 on line 15, that it's to be used upon further legislative appropriations for major maintenance or capital construction. So while it would create a fund that would be made available by the disposal of these lands, that those funds could not be used without legislative appropriation. So that is the protection. I think the reason that, this is an interesting section that we don't normally find in a lot of our proposals, that we create this kind of special fund. And I think that really to kind of understand some of the background of that is that, and the testimony is that these lands and these properties were acquired for the particular purpose of either the Department of Health or Department of Corrections, and they just felt like it was appropriate, since they were acquired historically for that purpose, that the revenues that received should remain you know, with that institution. However, it does require legislative appropriation, so I think that's the protection there. And two out of three of the departments that's involved in this proposal, the other one just, it wasn't that that individual was not there and not in favor, just that they didn't show up. But two out of three of them did show up. And this was something that they did say that was somewhat important to them in their support of this proposal, is that since they were required for that purpose, that they should remain for that purpose, however, would require further legislative appropriations for major maintenance or capital construction.
Chairman Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate the conversation and the question from the speaker, because that was also my question. But I am curious. I understand why the departments would like to be able to have that money, even though it will require an additional appropriation, why they would prefer that that money be locked up and further used by them. My question is, was there any consideration when we dispose of other lands that the state happens to own, that money generally flows to the permanent account and goes into savings? And so was there any conversation about the potential for that?
Chairman Representative Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The reason for that, we received in the committee, was that the Senate felt that these lands were acquired for an institution by a previous legislative body, and that those monies should remain with those institutions. And the directors felt that that was also very important as well.
Chairman Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The problem that I have with that is it could potentially create a negative incentive for institutions to dispose of lands so they could build up these special reserve accounts. And that would be a concern of mine.
Chairman Simulik.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We did have quite a little discussion on that point, and some of the questions that were asked during the committee is kind of to address that, is because we can go back to the school facilities program, and we ask our districts to do a 5 or 7 year plan in terms of facility needs, and we understand that these institutions are also have to do that same thing. So I think it's going to be a carefully laid out plan in terms of their needs. Facility needs for the future, and as long as the disposition of this land was consistent with that policy, I guess I had less concern about it. That the kind of thing that the good chairman of education referred to is not as likely to happen under a case of long range planning. But it is, we admit, it is something that is somewhat different, but I think the question has been asked and answered two or three different times why we did that, but it's just simply something that we felt, because they were acquired for the purpose of these facilities, that perhaps they should stay there. And again, I think the protection is with the legislature, that the appropriations that come out of that fund is going to have to be made through us, so we'll have control over that.
Is there further discussion? Question being called. We are voting on Senate File 90. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
The Senate File 90 is passed Committee of the Whole. We're now on Senate File 16. Will the reading clerk read the bill, please?
Senate File 16 from the Management Audit Committee, an act relating to aeronautics programs, modifying provisions of the Air Services Enhancement Program, transferring administration and final approval for loans under the Airport Construction and Improvement Loan Program from the Aeronautics Commission to the State Loan and Investment Board, repealing obsolete provisions, making conforming amendments, providing an appropriation, and providing for an effective date. Mr. Mr. Chairman, Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, to whom was referred Senate File 16, Engrossed, Aeronautics Programs, respectfully reports same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representatives Blake, Blevins, Campbell, Yeagy, McKim, Reeder, Dave Swanser, two no votes, Representative Hutchings and Laux, signed by Representative David Swanser, Chairman, and further reviewed by your committee, number two, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 16, Engrossed Aeronautics Programs, respectfully report saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representatives Burkhart, Escobel, Harshman, Moniz, Nicholas, Stubson, and Wallace, signed by Representative Harshman, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Zwanitzer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with recommendation that Senate File 16 Engrossed do pass. And I'll turn it over to the Vice Chairman of the Management Audit Committee.
Chairman Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen of the House, on the Management Audit Committee, we do several studies a year on how departments or programs within departments are functioning, and I guess overall we're interested in looking at if it's operating the way the original legislation was intending. And this is a result. Senate File 16 is a direct result of an audit that we did this year, and I think we had a report in, well, September of this year on the Aeronautics Commission. And there's two features, programs within the Aeronautics program itself that this bill gives rise to, or references, I should say. One is the Air Services Enhancement Program, and I'll talk briefly about that. And the other one is the Airport Construction Improvement Loan Program. And the first section is 10, really is important here in the bill, is 10-3-601 of the statutes. And that deals with the enhancement, the Air Service Enhancement Program. And the essential thing we learned with regard to this program is some of the original intentions of the enhancement program. And this is a subsidy, if you will, for commercial airports in the state to encourage passenger traffic, passenger activity, commercial passenger activity. And so if you look on page 3, we took some language out, include but not limited to. We've got more specific about it. The essential thing here is that we added what turns out to be an important, more important than what the original statute pointed to, was increasing the number of Wyoming passengers originating flights in Wyoming commercial airports rather than airports in other states. And that's found on line 11 through 14 on page 3. And people in the business refer to this issue as leakage. And that's what weakens commercial air viability within the state, is if people are going to a neighboring state north of us or a neighboring state south of us and avoiding patronizing and using available capacity in our existing airports. So anyway, we wanted to add that one, and one that was put in the statute, I think it was back in 2006 or 2007, involves down at line 17 and 18, where there was a goal of air passengers increasing the number of routes flown within the state, and at that time they thought there was still some hope that we'd end up having an intra-state linkage of one Wyoming airport to another Wyoming airport, and clearly that's not the direction that the aeronautics industry nationwide is going. That's not going to happen. They're just not using that as a criteria anymore for awarding these grants. Okay? So that explains what we have. Oh, then there is increase in the consistency of service in communities as a result. This is down in line 16 to 20 on 3. As a increase in consistency of service communities as a result of their service enhancement. And that's, of course, making a market environment where people can depend on flights on a regular and consistent basis over the long run. Now, the important part of the bill, probably the most important part of the bill, is found starting on page 4, where we talk about this really occurs on page 5, where we talk about loans for airport construction improvement. We have a program that they have kind of a loan access to loans in the total amount of $10 million from the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund, that they make loans to airports for improvements, and there's certain criteria that they use for awarding these long-term plans and things like that. But what we discovered during the audit is that the Aeronautics Commission and the staff there, they're not well suited or well adapted to doing loan servicing. And they really weren't interested in doing this anymore. Their expertise and their line of specialization is to determine the merits of airport improvements and be able to balance them from one commercial airport to another and allocate those limited amount of resources into the highest and best use. And so that's why you'll see language on the bottom of page 5 and the top of page 6, where we're making maximum use out of the Aeronautics Commission on recommending loans, but the actual servicing and the awarding of loans will be shifted to the State Loan Investment Board. And they're in the business of making loans. They've got people that do this kind of thing. And so we'll see language here on page 6 where we're talking, instead of the commission making and taking liens against facilities, it's the State Loan Investment Board that's doing that. And same way with line 15, the board will adopt rules and regulations to administer the loan. And we had them in there in to talk to us during this audit period and also during the preparation of this bill and the presentation in the committees, and they're fine with it. The only difference or the only thing here is that you need to see on Section 4 if there is an appropriation with it that is necessary, because the people that the land office or loan investment board office wants to use to service these loans and to kind of ride herd on them is they're federally funded positions, and you can't use federally funded positions or at least federally or paid by federal funds to do a state program. So the way that has to work, there's only about 6 or 7 loans that are outstanding, so it's not going to take hardly any time to deal with these that volume of loans. So they're estimating at a maximum it's going to take $10,000, as you see down here on line 21 of page 7, from the general fund to the Office of State Lands and Investment, and that's a way to replenish the federal commitment the commitment of federal workers and to reimburse for that amount of time that they use to service these loans. Now, the way this was going to work is that we know that 10,000 is probably too high, and if it turns out to be like 8,000 or something like that, that's the amount that we can expect to see in a standard budget from now on in this program. So that's the bill, and if there's any questions, I'll answer them, and if there isn't, I'll call for the question.
There is discussion. Representative Hutchings.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. This question is on page 5. Line 14. Sorry I didn't get this answered during committee, but I'd like to know, sir, if someone can answer this for me. Section A, the commission, is that the include the superintendent of public instruction or the new director? And if it does include the director, would that mean that the governor kind of has two votes? Thank you.
Chairman Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, this is not a bill about public instruction. This is a bill about the Aeronautics Commission. And the strikeouts you see on line 14 is referring to the Aeronautics Commission. Earlier in the statute that this is coming out of, they define the commission as the State Aeronautics Commission. And this is where we're transferring over the responsibility for making and servicing loans to the State Loan and Investment Board. So wherever it's appropriate, you'll see the commission being crossed out and replaced with State Loan and Investment Board. Thank you.
Seeing no more, Representative Patton, seeing no more discussion, are you ready for the, there is more discussion. Representative Hutchings.
Mr. Chairman, the two gentlemen in the back explained to me that the superintendent of public instruction would still be on that board. Thank you.
Question being called. We are voting on, we're voting on Senate File 16. All those in favor of the bill say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Senate File 16 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Majority Floor Leader Brown.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
Ready? Okay. Oh. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carries.
Reading clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. Speaker, your Committee of the Whole, having under consideration bills on general file, beg to leave report as follows. Senate File 113, recommended do pass. Senate File 162, amended, recommended do pass. Senate File 86, amended, recommended do pass. Senate File 99, recommended do pass. Senate File 9, recommended do pass. Senate File 115, recommended do pass. Representative Brown moved that the House rise and sit again. Senate File 146, amended, recommended do pass. Senate File 83, recommended do pass. Senate File 84, recommended do pass. Senate 147, amended and further amended, recommended do pass. Senate File 80, recommended do pass. Senate File 29, recommended do pass. Senate File 75, amended, recommended do pass. Senate File 90, amended, recommended do pass. Senate File 16, recommended do pass. Signed by Representative Eklund, Chairman.
Representative Eklund.
Mr. Speaker, I move the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You have heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Congratulations, Representative Eklund. Committee of the Whole report's been adopted. We're at that order of business of messages from the Senate.
Message number 350. Mr. Speaker, the bill listed below passed the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill 24, probate amendments, ayes 30. Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 351, Mr. Speaker, the bill listed below passed the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill 47, Confidential Student Disciplinary Hearing, ayes 28, noes 2, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 352, Mr. Speaker, the bill listed below passed the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill 51, Probate Objections to Appointment, ayes 29, noes 1, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 353, concurrence requested. Mr. Speaker, House Bill number 133, Human Trafficking, the House bill listed above, passed on third reading in an amended form as form as follows by the vote indicated, which was ayes 29, noes 1. The Senate respectfully asks the House to concur by adopting the listed amendments. Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 354, Mr. Speaker, the bill listed below passed the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bills number 153, representation of children in compact proceedings, ayes 30, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 355, Mr. Speaker, the bill listed below passed the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill 154, Representative Children in the CHINS Proceedings, ayes 30, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 356, Mr. Speaker, the bill listed below passed the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill number 225, Transfer of Ownership of Livestock and Brands, ayes 30, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 357, concurrence requested. Mr. Speaker, House Bill number 94, Immunization by Pharmacists, the House bill listed above, passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated, ayes 19, noes 11. The Senate respectfully asks the House to concur by adopting the listed amendments, and it's signed by Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 358, concurrence requested. Mr. Speaker, House Bill 187, Campaign Finance, the House bill listed above, passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated, ayes 18, noes 12. The Senate respectfully asked the House to concur by adopting the listed amendments. Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 359, concurrence requested. Mr. Speaker, House Bill number 215, State Investments for a Public Purpose, the House bill listed above, passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated, ayes 29, noes 0, 1 conflict. The Senate respectfully asked the House to concur by adopting the listed amendments, signed by Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk.
We are at that order of business of reading and signing enrolled acts. The first enrolled act is House Enrolled Act 41, being original House Bill 100.
Enrolled Act number 41, original House Bill number 100, an act relating to vehicle registration fees.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 41, being original House Bill 100. I have so signed. The next act for our consideration is House Enrolled Act 42, being original House Bill 248.
Enrolled Act number 42, original House Bill number 248, an act relating to administration of government.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 42, being original House Bill 248. I have so signed. The next enrolled act for our consideration is House Enrolled Act number 43, being original House Bill 65.
Enrolled Act number 43, from original House Bill number 65, an act relating to public health and safety.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 43, being original House Bill 65. I have so signed. The next enrolled act is House Enrolled Act number 44, being original House Bill 216.
Enrolled Act number 44, from original House Bill number 216, an act relating to crimes and offenses.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 44, being original House Bill 216. I have so signed. The next enrolled act for our consideration is House Enrolled Act 46, being original House Bill 25.
And Roll of Act Number 46 from Original House Bill Number 25, an act relating to paramutual wagering.
I'm about to sign House and Roll Act Number 46 being Original House Bill 25. I have so signed. The next enrolled act for our consideration is House Enrolled Act Number 47, being Original House Bill 32.
Enrolled Act Number 47, Original House Bill Number 32, an act relating to elections.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act Number 47, being Original House Bill 32. I have so signed. The next enrolled act for our consideration is House Enrolled Act 48, being Original House Bill 84.
Enrolled Act Number 48 from Original House Bill Number 84, an act relating to livestock fences.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act Number 48 being Original House Bill 84. I have so signed. The next Enrolled Act for our consideration is House Enrolled Act Number 49 being Original House Bill 90.
Enrolled Act Number 49 from Original House Bill Number 90, an act relating to landowner liability.
I'm about to sign in House Enrolled Act Number 49 being Original House Bill 90. I have so signed. The next Enrolled Act for our consideration is House Enrolled Act Number 50 being Original House Bill 98.
Enrolled Act Number 50 from Original House Bill Number 98, an act relating to county clerks.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act Number 50 being Original House Bill 98. I have so signed. The next Enrolled Act for our consideration is House Enrolled Act Number 59 being Original House Bill 117. Or House Bill 51 being Original House Bill 117.
Enrolled Act Number 51 from Original House Bill 117, an act relating to administrative procedure.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act Number 51 being Original House Bill 117. I have so signed. The next act for our consideration is House Enrolled Act Number 52 being Original House Bill 131.
Enrolled Act Number 52, Original House Bill 131, an act relating to game and fish.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act 52 being Original House Bill 131. I have so signed. The next act for our consideration is House Enrolled Act 53 being Original House Bill 146.
Enrolled Act Number 53 from Original House Bill Number 146, an act relating to athletic trainers.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act 53 being Original House Bill 146. I have so signed. The next act for our consideration is House Enrolled Act 54 being Original House Bill 150.
Enrolled Act Number 54 from Original House Bill 150, an act relating to motor vehicle titles.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act 54 being Original House Bill 150. I have so signed. The next act for our consideration is House Enrolled Act 55 being Original House Bill 171.
Enrolled Act Number 55 from Original House Bill 171, an act relating to taxation.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act 55 being Original House Bill 171. I have so signed. The next act for our consideration is House Enrolled Act 56 being Original House Bill 92.
Enrolled Act Number 56 from Original House Bill 92, an act relating to crimes and offenses.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act Number 56 being Original House Bill 92. I have so signed. The next act for our consideration is House Enrolled Act 57 being Original House Bill 86.
Enrolled Act Number 57 from Original House Bill Number 86, an act relating to Child Protection Act.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act 57 being Original House Bill 86. I have so signed. The next act for our consideration is House Enrolled Act 58, being Original House Bill 95.
Enrolled Act Number 58 from Original House Bill Number 95, an act relating to public safety.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act 58, being Original House Bill 95. I have so signed. The next act for our consideration is House Enrolled Act 59, being Original House Bill 128.
Enrolled Act Number 59 from Original House Bill Number 128, an act relating to game and fish.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act 59 being Original House Bill 128. I have so signed. The next act for our consideration is House Enrolled Act Number 60 being Original House Bill 72.
Enrolled Act Number 60 from Original House Bill Number 72, an act relating to the Teacher Accountability Act of 2011.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act Number 60B and original House Bill 72. I have so signed. The next act for our consideration is House Enrolled Act 61B and Original House Bill 81.
Enrolled Act Number 61 from Original House Bill Number 81, an act relating to the Wyoming Wildlife and Natural Resource Funding Act.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act Number 61B and Original House Bill 81. I have so signed. Great work, members of the House. That was about 25 House bills that we just signed into law. The next order of business is Representative Blake leading us in a song. We are at that order of business of committee announcements. Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Privilege. The legislative prayer breakfast is tomorrow morning at 6:45 at the Egg and I, and we'll have the pleasure of Lynn Kirkbride as the presenter. And with any luck at all, we'll have a past legislator by the name of Pete Anderson that will be with us tomorrow.
Chairman or Mr. Majority Whip.
Mr. Speaker, I just wanted to announce the Joint Conference Committee on House Bill 249 will meet tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock in room S13.
Madam Speaker Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your Joint Corporations Committee number 7 will meet tomorrow, Thursday, February 21st at 8:30 a.m. in room H18 for discussion of interim topics.
Representative Yagi.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The TRW committee would just like to remind everybody, or especially TRW members and anybody else that would like to go, the Game and Fish is giving a tour of the Iron Mountain Hunt area this Saturday at 9 o'clock, starting at the Game and Fish headquarters. Be back at 2. Thank you.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 10, Labor, will meet 10 minutes after adjournment today to discuss Senate File 153, and then we will meet again tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. to discuss Senate File 56.
Chairman Semlett.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Three separate announcements. First, the Joint Conference Committee on House Bill 156 was postponed today and will be rescheduled for tomorrow at 1:30 in H11. Also, members of the Select Water Committee will meet upon adjournment in S-15. And, Mr. Speaker, your committee number 5, Agricultural, Public Lands and Water Resources, will meet tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. in room H-11 to finish up our bills this year. House Senate File 136, Seismic Exploration, Senate File 66, State Funded Conservation Easements Restrictions, Senate File 137, Protection of Animals, Senate File 143, Cruelty to Animals, and Senate File 160, Pesticides.
Vice Chairman Crone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your committee number 1 will meet 7:45 tomorrow morning. We'll be heading to the Wyoming Highway Patrol Dispatch Center for a field trip. Everyone in the House is welcome to join committee number 1. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Vice Chairman Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 2, Appropriations, will meet at 9 o'clock in the morning in room 204 to address two bills, Senate File 149, a re-referred bill, and Senate File 125, public employees' requirements upon rehiring two. And additional re-referred bills as necessary and as time allows, and we will also probably touch upon interim topics.
Representative Vice Chairman McKim.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 8, Transportation, will meet tomorrow, Thursday, February the 21st, 10 minutes after adjournment, in room 817 to discuss interim topics.
Representative Escobar.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your conference committee on House Bill 250 will meet tomorrow afternoon at 1:30 with the like committee from the Senate to in the Appropriations Committee room.
Chairman Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your conference committee on House Bill 102 will meet immediately upon noon adjournment tomorrow in H-17, the House Labor Room. Also, 10 minutes upon adjournment today, we will meet in also H-17 to discuss Senate File 153, Unemployment Compensation Direct Sales. Thursday morning at 8 a.m., we will meet to discuss Senate File 56, Access to Records, Vulnerable Adult Abuse, and we will have the House Committee to discuss interim topics.
Representative Escobar.
Mr. Speaker, privilege of the floor.
Certainly.
Maybe you guys didn't know this, but my wife's a singer in a band, so if you're looking to blow off any steam Friday night, their band is playing at the Midtown Tavern at 8 o'clock. And they play the oldies all the way up to some of the new stuff like Adele and Grammy-winning songs that you probably recently heard, but they're pretty good. So they got brass section and all that good stuff. So come on out and watch them if you get a chance.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
General file for tomorrow is on the yellow sheet, but the two bills will be on there besides the ones that are on it. I'd like to get through 12 bills tomorrow. Mr. Speaker, I move the House adjourn until 10 o'clock a.m. tomorrow, February 21st, 2013.
Representative Wallace.
Mr. Speaker, I also need to announce that there's going to be a joint conference committee on House Bill 250. It'll be in appropriations at 1:30.
You've heard the motion. All in favor of adjourning until tomorrow, February 21st, 2013 at 10 a.m., say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House is in recess until tomorrow, February 20th, 2013 at, or February 21st, 2013 at 10 a.m.